This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. People around the country are continuing to react with anger and horror to the events that took place over the weekend at a white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia.
It was at this time last year that racial tensions bubbled to the surface in Milwaukee. The violence that erupted in Sherman Park following a police shooting put the challenges of Milwaukee's black-white relations front and center for the rest of the country to see.
But as many residents of Sherman Park would urge the country to take a more nuanced view of their neighborhood, writer Evie Perry suggests there's another area that's important to study for how diversity can work.
Perry is a sociology professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee, but a native of the Milwaukee area and author of the book Live and Let Live: Diversity, Conflict, and Community in an Integrated Neighborhood. That neighborhood was River West. I spoke with her earlier this summer on stage at Boswell Book Company. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
What was your objective as this project coalesced and you and your partner moved to the neighborhood?
I will be honest in saying that, like most ethnographers, I didn't really know what I was getting into. So I had a lot of questions and a place. But those questions changed because the place inevitably changed me. So we are both from here, and though I didn't go to graduate school here, I really, really wanted to come home to do my dissertation research. I love Milwaukee, I feel very invested in Milwaukee, and I feel very worried about Milwaukee, and want to be a part of telling stories about this place that help us move forward. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to do that, but my questions were both sort of personal and sociological. So I'd studied a lot about segregation. So, and a lot of folks had studied a lot about segregation. We knew a lot about segregation and all the bad things that segregation does in terms of exacerbating racial and class tensions, in terms of concentrating poverty, in terms of creating very deep political divides. But we didn't know a lot about integration. So people kind of treated it like this thing to be celebrated, like, of course, integration will solve all of our problems if we can just get people to live together and watch the magic happen. Or they said, you know, there seems to be a lot of conflict and integrated neighborhoods never last and they're sort of lousy, so we need to find another solution. And that seemed to me like a perfect place to step in and say, well, instead of what it can be or what it's failing to be, what is it actually?
Well, and so talk about your methodology. I mean, you talk about the personal and you talk about the sociological. Is there a complexity in the intersection of living in a place and also studying it?
Yes, I would say it's full of complexity, which is what makes it work. So I lived in the neighborhood for 3 years, and I just did life in the neighborhood in a sort of classic Evie, really intense way. So I became really, really embedded in neighborhood life, sought out all different sorts of people to talk to spend time with, to go about their daily rounds with them, to sit on their porches, to go to all sorts of clubs and activities, and again, 36 bars. And I think there's something about doing the life of a neighborhood as a new person that makes you really, really sensitive to the ways in which you are adjusting to a new place and how people deal with it in really different ways from you and different ways from one another. And of course, interviewing people is invaluable. I think you also enjoy interviewing people. And so that was a really wonderful way, and I see some people I interviewed here, for people to really share their journey through this neighborhood, if they were potentially born in it or moved to it, and sort of what it became to them. I think the complexity for me was when I actually had to sit down and write the thing, to see patterns and really document those patterns and be very honest about what I saw and work on not sort of overly romanticizing a place that I had totally fallen in love with.
Well, right. I mean, if doing what you were doing kind of gave you license to be nosy, and I think I know a little something about that phenomenon, what were the kinds of questions that you were asking, and did you see things change over the 3 years that you lived there in terms of how willing people were to share, you know, their warts and all kinds of impressions of the place that they live and love?
So I'll start with change over time. I think I was actually astounded by how willing people were to share warts and all with me from the beginning. And I think I was able, I'd like to believe I was able to build some level of trust that what I was really invested in was understanding how they saw things. Not this perfect picture, or even a picture that mattered for anyone else, but just you. How do you, living in this neighborhood, how do you see it? What worries you? What do you love? When do you think about moving, if ever? And I was amazed at people's generosity. I think what changed for me was that the neighborhood became familiar. And so it's funny looking back at my field notes from my early days in the field, the things that shocked me or surprised me, the noises, for example, I couldn't even hear them by the time I left. So I would usually, and this could be an informal interaction or sitting down and interviewing someone, I would always ask people stories. So what is the story of how you came to live in this neighborhood? And again, for some people, it was they were born in the neighborhood. And then I would have them take me through lots of their contrasts, their evaluations, best and worst, things they would love to see, things that have changed, their perceptions of change, and let their stories lead me into our exploration. And again, always encouraging people to embed their observations in things that actually happen.
Well, and so I feel like this is almost tantamount to asking you to go through your book point by point. But what were the primary sources of tension that you identified, even among people who were, by and large, it seems, very glad to be where they were? What were the points of friction?
So there were smaller frictions and larger frictions. And because I focused so much on life on the block, I was really interested in those everyday kinds of tensions and conflicts. And those were over all sorts of things. Property maintenance, how well did you keep up your house, or how wild is your garden? Noise level, right? So how loud are you? Child rearing. You know, what are the ways in which you're raising your children out in public? Public drinking, substance abuse, leisure activities, what's disruptive, what's okay? Economic activities, what's not legal and okay, what's not legal and okay? These everyday kinds of negotiations. And those tensions, though they sometimes created negative sorts of conflict, sometimes even violence, certainly hurt feelings, I, in the end, came to see as really vital to neighborhood life. That conflict, actually, these little conflicts produced these opportunities to get to know people, to understand what kind of our standards are, as flexible and kind of fluid as they may seem, and to not have one standard for a way to be in a neighborhood that had so many different kinds of people being in so many different kinds of ways. And without that conflict, I feel like the most dominant would win, and they would sort of push down their way of being in the world on the rest. And instead, it was just this sort of beautiful, sometimes ugly, often funny river of negotiation. And I'd like to think that along the way, sometimes people also got a better sense of where someone else was coming from. Because if I'm never going to engage with you about why you're making me so mad, Mitch, I'm not going to learn much about why you do what you do.
One of the conflicts that really stuck with me is this, I think you call it a neighborhood navigation rubric, a very sociological term for a chart. Can you describe the distinction between the ideas of live and let live, which, you know, product placement here, and hold to a higher standard?
So this was one of those larger tensions that I saw playing out in the neighborhood. So live and let live, these folks tended to see the neighborhood as a place that needed to be preserved and protected. So diversity is our strength was an actual mantra that I heard again and again and again. And for them, problems were defined not in a really clear-cut way. So something wasn't problematic because it was illegal. It wasn't problematic because it was in violation of a city code. It was problematic when it did harm. And harm could be addressed on a block-by-block basis, on a neighbor-by-neighbor basis. And so the way that they went about dealing with problems started with talking with the neighbor, right? So that was the approach. And only if things really escalated would they move to something like calling a landlord, calling the Department of Neighborhood Services, calling police. So there was this kind of this slow escalation, personal first. Hold the neighborhood to a higher standard. These are people who are also very deeply invested in the neighborhood, who really cared about River West. And they were really invested in its potential. So they wanted to see it grow and develop. They wanted to see crime drop. They wanted to see smart economic development. You know, sometimes they wanted to see their property values rise, which I think we can understand. And they wanted to hold the neighborhood to a higher standard. and a very clear set of standards, standards that are laid out in what is legal, standards that are laid out in, you know, what is also sort of just mainstream white right, like a version, a cultural version of good. And they, though they sometimes engage neighbors, were much more quick to call police or pulling the authorities and tended to have really strong relationships with people in power and were able to use those to the advantage. So I think these are people who are all invested in the neighborhood, but have very different ways of defining and dealing with problems.
I gather that graffiti is one of those areas where this really sort of comes to a head.
It is indeed. Is graffiti art or is it blight? Does it signal that this is a creative neighborhood full of artists, or does it signal that this is a dangerous neighborhood where we have lost all control? So this was certainly one area where there was a lot of disagreement. And one of the interesting projects some of you may know about is the Art in the Alleys project, where some neat folks in the neighborhood asked muralists to throw up murals on people's garages in the alleys in the neighborhood. And a lot of homeowners agreed, and a lot of artists readily agreed, and some of them looked like graffiti. And this really upset some residents. They thought that somehow there's art and then this is something else. And I think it's not, if you push that a little bit further, sometimes it's something else is youth, it's crime, and it's black and brown people. This kind of tangle of pathology that is associated with graffiti. And neighborhood folks fought back and forth. When larger issues came up around the city, when a Southside alderman tried to pass something that basically said that you can't put up graffiti on your own property, River Westerners went nuts and let him know just what they thought of that proposed ordinance. But, you know, it's really hard. For some people, they feel like it's sending the wrong signal about the neighborhood. It looks like disorder. And for other people, it looks like a place they value and love.
A lot of people, academics and the rest of us alike, have made the point that we're not always very good at living with difference. After all of your research, do you think the people of River West are any different? Realizing that many of them are in this room?
Yes. Yeah, I think in many ways, we, people living in the United States, are not very good at living with difference. And I think a big reason why we are not good at living with difference is because we don't have a lot of good practice. And I think that's particularly true for people with more power, people who have, people who have lots and lots of resources, people who are white. I think it's because of segregation. And so lousy practice or a lack of practice can generate some a real lack of skills, I guess. So yes, in some ways I think people in River West have figured out and are constantly in the process of figuring out ways to live with difference. It is not, however, a story that is simple or easy. So one of the things that I learned from people in River West is that it takes work, and it takes work all the time. So if you're really willing to regularly be engaging people and trying to understand them in context, I mean, I think of it as kind of like a practical empathy. And I don't think people necessarily develop it because they want to be good. I think it's a good way to survive in River West and thrive in River West. Is to, for example, pay attention to your neighbors. I mean, there's some River West folks here, I think you know this. You pay attention to your neighbors, you're gonna make your life easier, your block safer. So there's this shared fate. Sometimes it comes in the form of shared threat that really encourages people to engage and work things out. And I think there are a lot of lessons we have from River Westerners. I think if we look at a lot of diversity initiatives in corporations or universities, they're very much about sort of bringing people in and having people act like us and get with the program. And River West, that doesn't fly. It's subtle, but it's radical. It's, okay, come on in and let's see what mess we can kind of create together.
I think 3 years of work went into this. At the end of those 3 years, what questions did you still have that you don't think you were able to answer?
So many. First, how do we maintain this? So even one of the questions that I was able to, I think, answer to a certain degree is, so how is it that this continues beyond year after year? It's difficult to see how, in the face of continued threats for things like gentrification or decline, and a profound lack of affordable housing, how in particular we'll be able to maintain class diversity. I'm not sure how to do that. And a question that I get a lot is, so how do we create this elsewhere? What does this look like in policy? And if you look at some of the mixed income communities that policy has created, I mean, HUD, Housing and Urban Development, has put tons of money into tearing down concentrated poverty projects and building mixed income communities. And those communities typically do not look anything like River West. Poor people in those communities, the renters and the public housing residents, are heavily policed. They're under a lot of surveillance and generally feel excluded, even though they're integrated, they're excluded. And how do you translate something that is really deeply cultural when you're building it from scratch? So those are some of the questions I'm left with.
Well, and do you feel like, I mean, is it your job as a sociologist and an ethnographer to suggest what to do with what you learned, or do you sort of have to be able to turn this information and these lessons you got loose and let people do with it as they can?
Yes and yes. I do not pretend for a minute to have all or even many of the answers. Although I do think a lot of River Westerners have some great answers, some of whom didn't agree with me at all. I think that it is my responsibility as someone who has been lucky enough to study a place, to share that place, and to really think deeply about how we might translate this into some positive change. I mean, I'm a sociologist because I care deeply about justice, and I am a ridiculous optimist, and actually think that we are capable of creating a more just and equitable society. But I know that I need a team to do that. So I don't pretend, I don't have the hubris to claim that I have the answers. But I also think that it's important to really invest in the scientific project of simply understanding. And absolutely, if you make it accessible enough, which I hope this is, turning it over to people who can make it even better.
Well, and so I feel like this is a loaded question. Milwaukee, for a couple of years, has gotten a national reputation as this segregated place where people just aren't getting along. Do you think there's a counter narrative that needs to happen to get the message of Milwaukee out to the rest of the country? And does that counter narrative include River West?
I think we need two sets of counter narratives. I think we really need some internal counter narratives. So I listen a lot to the stories that people tell me about their neighborhoods and where they live. I also listen to people tell me about the places they won't go or don't go and why. And I think in Milwaukee, a lot of folks have stories about places they won't go and reasons for why they won't go there that are uncharitable, damaging, wrong, unfair. And I think that if we start taking the time to change our narrow-minded and limited stories about other places in the city, that's a really good start to trying to tell other people about who we are as a different place. So yes, and certainly I think River West is part of that story. Again, it's not like River West is trouble-free. I know there are lots of things that I think are really amazing about it. It has its own challenges. And I think we have a lot to learn from that place. But for starters, you know, think about the places that you drive through and the assumptions you make about what you see. And that was one of the amazing things about River West. What looks like chaos and trash to outsiders is gold sometimes, or at least entertaining to insiders. And then inevitably, I think, it will change the ways that we think about and define a good neighborhood. I think that goes right along with the really simplistic stories we tell about good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods, and I dare you to find me one of either of those.
Evie Perry is a sociology professor at Rhodes College in Tennessee and is a Milwaukee area native. Her recent book about River West is called Live and Let Live: Diversity, Conflict, and Community in an Integrated Neighborhood.